Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you. Hosted by your local Labour MPs.
Hi everyone and welcome to Red Alert Radio on Planet FM 104.6. My name is Priyanka Radhakrishnan and I'm a policy advisor with the Labour Party. In today's show, we're going to be discussing an issue that's been, in the media a fair bit of late, or at least in the last year. We'll be talking about migrant worker exploitation. And joining me here in the studio, I have Dennis Maga. Dennis, welcome.
Kia ora, Priyanka, and kia ora koutou katoa to the listeners.
Dennis Maga is a national organizer at First Union and the coordinator of the Union Network of Migrants. So, Dennis, in the past year or so, we've heard and we've read of a fair few cases of migrant exploitation, or as some would call it, basically modern-day slave labor. Most of what I've read has been quite sickening in terms of the level of abuse that's been perpetrated. And there have been some high-profile cases where employers have been ordered to pay penalties and arrears as well. Could you tell us a little bit or give us a bit of an overview of what migrant exploitation is?
Yeah, it's quite timely that the Union Network of Migrants and First Union have been reviewing this case for the past 8 years. Why we need to establish that in the past 8 years, because media is asking us that the level of exploitation or exploitation cases, are they isolated or not? And we keep on answering that question. I think right now it is established that the exploitation is happening in New Zealand, and particularly the regions that are heavily affected by work exploitation against migrants, basically Auckland, Christchurch, and dairy farming area, and including horticulture. Okay. In terms of the areas like Auckland, Christchurch, what we establish, and even in Wellington in some cases, there are large exploitation and hospitality business where migrants are actually not paid based on a minimum wage, and they are actually being asked to work more long hours. Mm-hmm. And we also have some experience, for example, those international students who finish their diploma in management, for example, that they have to buy their job, and we call that premium. So meaning if ever you finish diploma in management, obviously you're just 22 or 23 years old and you don't have any New Zealand experience, the question is who would actually employ you for that management job? So, for example, in the case of Masala, which we had a member in a similar situation, our member actually had to give the company between 15 to 20 grand, okay, or $20,000 in order to provide him a store manager position. Okay, and while he was working for that premium that he has to pay the employer, he was also forced to work 48 hours a week, but the company is only paying him 20 hours.
Right.
So those were the level of exploitation that we actually experienced in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And we also had some experience where the company had actually promised them to work for 40 hours and they've been recruited from overseas. And once they arrive here in New Zealand, the employer substituted their employment agreement. If ever it was actually stated $18 an hour, the company will be actually changing that to minimum wage. And in our experience, those employees are not also getting the statutory entitlements such as the sick leave, such as holiday.
Right.
So they're not enjoying that. Basically, while they were experiencing that in hospitality, it's a very concerning for us. And then we look at the extent or how rampant this problem is, and we check that it's not only happening in hospitality but also in retail, especially if ever you go to different small supermarkets owned by former immigrants.
Right.
In fact, in the Chinese community, someone had told us that a large portion of them are not paying minimum wage. And in the Chinese community, there is some acceptance that the minimum wage is $8 an hour. So there were employees who actually approached us regarding that. But the problem is it's very hard to prosecute or file legal proceedings against the employer because they're quite smart nowadays. So what they normally do is they're being paid on a cash basis. Mm-hmm. So it's quite hard to track down about how these workers are being paid.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So basically what you're saying is that some of the issues that you've experienced in the work that you do is low pay for people of for migrants here, basically. And I think we've seen in the Masala case, on average, it was $4 an hour that people were being paid. And in the Genki, the Japanese restaurants, it was something like $3.75, if I remember correctly. So well below minimum wage. In some communities, the understanding of what the minimum wage is actually much lower. Lower than what it is legally. Conditions are potentially bad. Just touching on the premiums that you mentioned. Now, I've actually supported an individual through this who was being exploited, and he told me that in some cases he was actually taken to an ATM and asked to withdraw certain amounts of money to give it back to the employer. So is that how premiums work? Is that why it's difficult to keep tabs on, because it's not a bank-to-bank transfer, so you can't actually see where the money's going? Yes. Is that an issue you've seen?
Yes, yes. In fact, if ever you will visit one of the recent cases that we won in employment court, the union actually filed a case against E-Advance Limited, where Indians and Filipinos had been asked to pay a sum of between $5,000 to $20,000 in exchange for a position that will enable them to get a work visa. All right. So basically, most of them had paid premium in order to get those positions.
Right.
Because that's how the director market those jobs for them after they finish some sort of diploma in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. So that's how they operate. And we look at whether this is only happening in one ethnic group. But it seems that most immigrants have been actually using this as a way or scam to exploit their own people. So it's happening among Indian community, Chinese community, and even Filipino community.
Right.
In fact, I'm still waiting for one lady. She's a Chinese. That there's a one famous coffee shop that she was asked to pay for $15,000 in exchange for, again, a managerial position.
Right.
And there were only two of them working in that coffee shop.
Right.
That lady and the owner. So it's going to be hard to justify that immigration in New Zealand. But however, that's the way they operate nowadays.
Yeah.
So the question is that, okay, if ever the employers can get away from it in order to circumvent the permanent residency pathway for these migrants. So meaning, aside from exploitation, we are also condoning some sort of corruption in the country. Because meaning, if ever there's a culture that we can do this, so meaning we can get away from this. So this is concerning for our society, because one thing that I'm very proud of in this country is that it is less corrupt compared to other countries.
Yes.
And we should keep it that way. And that's the reason why our union is very active on exploitation, because these rogue employers must be stopped.
Absolutely. Now, I'm going to ask you a slightly controversial question. Every time I talk about the issue of migrant worker exploitation, whether it's on Facebook or other social media platforms, there's invariably one person who will, you know, who will comment and say, oh, it happens, you know, it's basically ethnic people doing it to other ethnic people. And so what my question to you is, and you've mentioned that it happens a fair bit, and I understand that. Now, I've got a view on this. Yeah. But are we just worse as people, or do we know the loopholes that we can exploit because we've come as immigrants ourselves? What's your view on that?
In 2011, I think even Immigration New Zealand and a couple of research actually back up some data that the exploitation is happening within the immigrant community. And the reason for that is those former immigrants have been there. So correct. They know the system. And it's going to be hard for them to exploit Kiwis because Kiwis are fully aware of their rights. And basically, they will not enter into that kind of situation. I think we have to start from here. If, for example, a Chinese worker arrive in New Zealand and the Chinese cannot speak English properly, then you don't expect this Chinese can simply apply for a job in a restaurant where most of the customers will be Kiwis or speak English. Okay, so they do struggle to find a job. So that actually gives an opportunity for some immigrant employers out there to offer them some sort of job, that because you cannot find a job, come work for me and I'm going to be offering you this money. So out of desperation, they accept that. All right. And one thing that I need the listeners to understand, for an immigrant, there are two concepts of living wage. Okay, one is the living wage when you are living in New Zealand, and the second concept of living wage is for an overseas worker where the family is staying from their country of origin. Their understanding of living wage is based on their country of origin and not based in New Zealand. Okay, so meaning if ever you were paid $4 or $8 an hour, and you will compare that to your country of origin, I'll give you some example. Even in India and in Philippines, the 1 hour minimum wage here in New Zealand will be equivalent to 1 day in India and in the Philippines. That's how it actually works. So they feel that if ever they are earning $4, $5, or $6 an hour, they're actually benefiting from it because they convert between to a currency. However, once the family decided to migrate to New Zealand, then their concept of living wage suddenly changed. That is the time they realize that I cannot survive with $6 or $8 an hour. I have to fight for my rights. Otherwise, my family will not be able to survive, and I cannot pay for a 2- or 3-bedroom house with that wages. So that is the time that they started questioning and challenging the employer.
Right.
All right. So from the time that they're still enjoying the convenience, there is no employment relationship problem. But once the family circumstances or the individual circumstances have changed, then that's the time that started to complain and actually look for authorities or unions or community organizations who can help them.
Right. That's fascinating. That's actually not a view that I've heard before. So thank you for that. So basically what you're saying is, because of conversion rates, when you come here as a migrant and you earn an amount that's below minimum wage, when you convert it to what that would translate in money back home, it seems like it's a fair amount. But then once they've realized that that's actually not going to be feasible, financially viable in New Zealand, that's when they realize that they've been exploited, and they look for agencies who can work with them or advocate for them to, I guess that coupled with a lack of knowledge around what their legal rights are in New Zealand, and added complications like a language barrier and a lack of support networks, because the people I've spoken to and worked with, you know, had a language barrier, but also came here and would, you know, talk to and interact with people from their same community because that was familiar. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I guess added to the other vulnerabilities, it makes them more vulnerable to exploitation by people from their own community, in a sense.
Absolutely. Based on our cases, those migrant workers who actually filed complaint, mostly they were actually backed up by their community. And if there was, if there's no community, the exploitation will actually continue for quite such a, for at least 12 to 24 months.
Right.
Yeah. So the community here is very important, and even the existence of organizations around them who can actually speak the language, who can communicate to them. Because one thing that I'm very disappointed, when a migrant worker arrived in New Zealand, just count how many leaflets out there at the airport. Hundreds of them. Now, a migrant worker will not be able to read all of them. Okay. What they want to do is to find someone that they can speak with and basically translate, or not literally translate, but explain to them how this society works compared to their country of origin.
Right. So a little bit of understanding about the culture and how things work in New Zealand. That's a really good segue into the next part of what I'd like to talk to you about, which is what can we do? So we know we've established that there's a problem. The authorities have finally recognized that this is an issue. I believe what we're seeing is the tip of the iceberg. It's a much bigger problem, I feel, than what we're reading about. Now, last year, the Immigration Amendment Bill passed into law, and as a result of that, exploitation of migrant workers can now lead up to 7 years in jail. Those who exploit can be jailed for up to 7 years, and there's also, and potentially deported if the offenders are permanent resident holders and the exploitation happens within 10 years of them gaining residence. I think there was also something about search powers being extended into employers' premises. But is this far enough? Is this good enough in your estimate?
Look, we can even actually put there, or they can continue to amend that and put 25 years imprisonment, $1 million penalty. But our point is this. While the government is looking for a way to penalize those rogue employers, the fact remains that how can we penalize them if ever there are only few cases that we actually prosecuted as a country? So the government must be proactive regarding that. But however, one, do they have enough budget to do that? The second one, do they have enough manpower? The third one is very important, which is, I think, is the primary concern. If you look at for the past 8 years, in terms of migration strategy, one thing that we notice is that this government actually focused on delivering for low-skilled and low-wage migration policy, all right? And especially in terms of the influx of international students right now, which we actually call education trafficking, all right, they contributed to the number of labor force right now, which would affect the labor market, okay? And most of them, because they are also desperate to survive and pay for their food and pay for their rent, they will be actually competing now with some hospitality work and retail work and even in logistics. And some of them have been actually working in some orchard company. And we found out that most of those international students have been working there during weekends and they're just getting paid for $10 an hour. Okay, so they're selling the labor power right now for a much lower compared to the statutory requirement. But the problem right now is this: how long are we going to facilitate that kind of migration? Because you, in one end, you have a harsh penalty, but the second one, you keep on actually allowing them to be exploited. Because if there is no plan, basically to address those concerns, and especially without assuring that there will be some migrant rights in the process, then I don't think that we are doing well in terms of addressing the problem. We're just simply patching up the hole, but we are not basically changing the system regarding that.
Yeah, no, you make a good point, because I guess when you talk about justice for, in terms of any issue, you're talking both about holding offenders accountable and also protections for those who are victims of whatever the injustice is. So it does seem to me that it's with the amendment act, that it seems to be quite weighted in favor of penalties rather than protections for and I'll get to the point that you're making in terms of the system a little bit later, but even in terms of balancing accountabilities versus protections for victims, it feels to me that there's not a lot being done to make it a safe space for people to even report what they're experiencing. But in terms of the structures, the system, that's quite interesting. If you held the pin on changing the structure, changing our migration or immigration policy, what would be, say, three things that you would do?
I think there are two things here. It's not only about immigration, but even the employment, because our biggest problem is that how about those Phoenix companies? You file a case against them, and then later on you found out that they are now in the process of liquidation.
That's right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because it's a limited company when they register that. Therefore, the board of directors are not liable to that. All right. Unless Immigration New Zealand will step up and intervene, then they can find some legal proceedings in order to criminally prosecute them. Mm. Okay. So that is only a relief for us. But however, they're also actually choosing about which cases that they would actually prosecute. But there are many small players out there.
Sure.
And our biggest concern is that if ever the company is being operated by one or two employees, and there's only one immigrant employer and exploiting these two, how active is the Labor Inspectorate Office and Immigration in New Zealand to prosecute them?
Mm.
Okay.
Mm.
Because what they've been doing is that they're targeting the big fish out there. All right. So meaning if ever you're a small fish, you can get away from it.
Mm.
So even if ever you have a harsh penalty, but we don't have enough system, enough resources and manpower to prosecute them,
correct,
still remain to be seen whether we can actually solve that in the next 5 or 10 years. Now,
sure,
in terms of migration, what I would say is that we have to review about the migration direction of this country right now.
Mm.
We have to review about what are we going to do with international students, because I'm saying that we are victimizing them. We are marketing New Zealand as a country, a destination for international students, but the way we market that is quite misleading. And these education agents from offshore are getting away from it.
Mm.
But the government is enjoying that because we're earning $3.8 billion a year.
Mm.
And yet we're not doing something about that.
Mm, mm. So a fair few issues, I guess, all tied up with this broader issue of exploitation. Just going back to what you said about the Labor Inspectorate, from memory, I think there are about 11 inspectors for the Auckland Northland area, which seems to me quite low. Is that an issue of resourcing then for the Labor Inspectorate?
In fact, right now we are working with the labor inspectors, and I do understand their concern because if ever you have only 11, even if ever you add 4, the gravity of exploitation practices is not actually normal. All right, they are fully aware of this, and they have some audits that they conducted. What we've been asking actually from the government is that can we actually give some authority or power to the labor inspector that if ever they can conduct an initial visit to check the health and safety, whether employers are complying with that, can we also translate that to give authority to labor inspector to conduct random checking and check whether this employer is actually complying with the statutory requirements of the law. And the second one, and basically give them the power to say that this company, for example, or this coffee shop is complying with the minimum entitlements, so blah, blah, blah. Okay. So because in that way, we can, once you actually buy a coffee in that coffee shop, for example, you're fully aware that they're complying, that there's a compliance. Because right now, there's no mechanism regarding that.
Mm.
So we have to rely on the community to report those kind of anomalies before they can take actions. All right?
Right.
Because there is no mechanism to conduct those random checking unless the community actually reported that to the authority.
Sure. But I guess my concern is if the labor inspectors or the inspectorate is to be able to do that, to conduct random checks and also to maybe look into every case that comes their way and not just pick the big fish, as you put it, then they would need to have more of them and I guess more money as well, and potentially more power or authority, as you said, to be able or allowed to do that.
Well, for example, we're earning $3.8 billion in terms of for inviting international students here. Then how come we cannot use that to give them more resources?
Yeah.
And I fully support the labor inspectors. But at the end of the day, even though they're not saying that, but I truly believe that they need more manpower.
Sure.
And not only manpower, but more authority. Because the state authority right now, the police authority rather, is only given to Immigration New Zealand because of that Immigration Amendment Act.
Correct.
But the Labor Inspectorate doesn't have that. All right?
Correct.
They have to rely first that there is a complaint. Otherwise, they cannot simply check that or investigate the matter without that.
Right. So more funding and a mandate.
Yes,
is what they need.
Yeah.
Very quickly now, because we're getting to the end of our segment, but very quickly, in terms of liquidation, now my experience of this is with the limited liability companies. If there's an issue and the company goes into liquidation, then there's actually nothing that the Employment Relations Authority can do to take them to court, unless I think the company directors okay that. And, you know, if they're complicit in the exploitation, then I think it's logical to assume that they wouldn't be okay with liquidators taking them to...
Although under Employment Relations Act, again, I'm going back to the Labor Inspectorate because they're the only agency which can actually prosecute and continue, and not really prosecute, but file cases against the employer and recover those money owed by employer to the exploited migrants. And then in terms of accountability of the directors, then Immigration New Zealand can actually file a legal proceedings against them. And I believe that there are a couple of prosecutors doing that in some of those reported rogue employers. But again, the question remains is that how much manpower they have to do that.
Sure.
Okay, because the number is very limited right now. I think my biggest concern is that are we adapting to the numbers of exploitation cases? Because the migration is actually getting bigger right now. And in terms of practices, they're getting smart. Like, for example, we have some cases lately that instead of bank transfer, they use cash transaction.
Right. So it can't be traced.
It's going to be hard, especially for us as employment relations advocate, if ever we decided to pursue personal grievance or refile case against the employer. It's going to be hard for us to justify that sure. there is exploitation because of that cash transactions. So those will be the gray area.
Right. So it becomes a lot more difficult to trace and therefore to prove, I guess. Mm. Yeah. So I guess what I'm hearing from you is that what we have now with the Immigration Amendment Act is better penalties in a sense, so harsher penalties, but we also need to look at the protective factors, so what can we do to ensure that these cases are reported, but we also need to make sure that people know that they will be caught if they do this, because and I think that's a huge issue, because if you think you're going to get away with it, then chances are you're not going to change what you do. You're just going to keep abusing or exploiting.
Absolutely.
If you're not caught, then the harsher penalties don't apply.
Exactly. And I think what I would like to say is that there is the role of the community to be active in this.
Yes.
Because sometimes if the community is complicit, then we cannot resolve the matter as well. We have to involve the community. And I think, for example, I'm going to be going to the Caritas launch of their research about the migrants' exploitation. Right. So I think if the churches are stepping up, okay, and basically defining their role, and if ever this kind of thinking and services can be extended, then I think we will be able to help the government as well to sure. address the problem.
Sure. So we all have a part to play, and I'm going to add to that, I'm going to add the temples, the mosques, and the gurdwaras as well, the Sikh temples. We all have a role to play in supporting one another to get out of exploitative situations. Now, just before we end, there is a number they can, so people, if they find that they're in a situation of exploitation, they can call the Labor Inspectorate. Is that right?
I will always recommend those exploited migrants to contact the labor inspectors. They know how to handle those cases. I'm not speaking on behalf of them, but based on my experience, they're quite good in handling those.
Fabulous.
And then they can also visit unimig.org.nz if ever they would like to seek assistance from us.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Dennis. It's been absolutely fabulous to have a chat with you about this this issue of migrant exploitation, which is tragic, really, is all I can say. Once again, thank you so much, and thank you to all our listeners.
Get together with your local MP next week at 9.05 a.m. Or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/red.